This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. In part four of Landlord v. Tenant, hear from Bloomington landlord Cynthia Shepherd, who rents almost exclusively to low-income tenants.
There's some tenants, usually the ones that I evict, are going to be the ones that think I'm a slumlord. I don't quite understand that, because all my retirement money goes into my rental properties.
She's been cited numerous times for code violations, and hear about the difficulties tenants face in taking their landlord to court. Plus, ISU reacts to Education Secretary Betsy DeVos's announcement that Title IX has not been sufficiently careful of the rights of the accused in campus rape cases. And Ecology Action Center Director Michael Brown previews the community household hazardous waste collection event at the Rivian Auto Plant. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A mother with six children wanted to escape dangerous living conditions in Chicago when she moved to Bloomington. Now she faces eviction here for withholding rent from a landlord she says failed to make critical repairs and address an insect infestation. In this part of our investigative series, Landlord v. Tenant, GLT's Judy Valenti explores difficulties tenants face in taking landlords to court and talks with a landlord who says the public doesn't understand pressures rental property owners face.
The first thing you notice about the rental home at 705 South Center Street is that the front door doesn't lock. The posts holding up the porch shake when you touch them. Inside the front hall, there's mold from floor to ceiling on one wall, and large pieces of the wall are missing due to apparent water damage. Moesha Tyner lives in this Bloomington rental with her six children. She takes me up a narrow staircase leading from the front door to her second floor unit.
Okay, so we'll walk upstairs now, some narrow, pretty steep steps here, which are not lit.
The stairs are wet.
The stairwell is dark. The hall light switch doesn't work. Inside the apartment, she shows me her bathroom. When we step on the floor, it sinks.
This is my bathroom where the most problem come in at, that as you can see around here, it's not safe or anything. As right here, you can see where it's caving in.
You're stepping on it and it's moving.
Yes, it's moving. I think it's very unsafe, because I think one day, if the kids continue to take baths and showers up in here, it's going to cave in.
Then there are the bugs. Flies and mosquitoes come in.
Yes, very, very badly.
Several windows don't have screens. The glass is missing from windows in the basement, on the second floor in her children's playroom, and in the attic. Tyner pulls out a cell phone and displays photographs of her young daughter with insect bites.
This is one of my daughter Erin from her being bite from a bug. This is the side of her face being bite from a bug. These are the roaches when I sprayed.
Another photo shows the extent of the roach infestation, despite Tyner's attempts to spray the unit daily with insect repellent.
So you have about a few dozen dead roaches that you swept up after you sprayed.
Yes, they are. As you can see.
I see that you try to keep your kitchen as clean as possible.
Everything, all your food protected, because it's roaches. As you can see.
Tyner says the roaches were there when she moved in, but she had little choice but to take the 3-bedroom apartment when she arrived in Bloomington from Chicago about 2 years ago. It was big enough for her large family, and at $700 a month, it was something she could afford, barely, on her $9 an hour job at Burger King. Plus, she was happy to leave her previous neighborhood in Chicago.
I came from Chicago due to the fact we had a fire. A man was on our porch dead. I came to Bloomington to change our life, and that's what I thought.
Tyner says she tried numerous times to contact her landlord, Cynthia Shepherd, asking her to make repairs and have the unit professionally fumigated.
Yes, I complained to my landlord several times. I was told not to contact her by phone, or she would be taking me to court to leave the premises.
Shepherd does business as Shackman Rentals and owns 50 buildings in Bloomington. Her units have been cited so many times for housing code violations, city officials say they've stopped counting. She is a regular in the administrative housing court, appearing on multiple cases in a single day.
Hello there. Are you Cynthia Shepherd? Okay, I'm Judy Valente. I just wanted to talk to you for a little bit about some of your properties.
I visited Shepherd in her office on Main Street. Tenants stream in and out to pay rent, usually in cash. Shepherd says she considers herself a champion of the poor.
My specialty is single mothers. And a lot of these women are very young, and a lot of them have multiple children, even though they're under 25. And the men are in prison. The men are not coming up with any money for them. And so they do run into problems, and they have to rely on their family and friends and co-workers to help them, and they're usually in the same boat.
Shepherd says the public generally doesn't understand the difficulties landlords face or the costs involved in keeping up properties. She says she spends about $10,000 a month to pay maintenance workers. After she retired as a paralegal with the Illinois Supreme Court, she says she had to take a job as a supermarket cashier to help support herself and pay her business expenses.
There's some tenants, usually the ones that I evict, you know, are going to be the ones that think I'm a slumlord, I guess. But I don't quite understand that because I have never had any money for myself. That's why I had to work a full-time and a part-time job. And that money, all my retirement money, goes into Shackman, into my rental properties, which is $10,000 a month.
Shepherd blames her tenants for the disrepair in their units. She says she has sent maintenance workers to address some of Tyner's complaints.
And what my maintenance guy noticed when he was up there to do some work, first of all, there were so many children running back and forth, he was actually afraid to leave tools there. And he thought if he turned around quickly, he would hurt somebody because they weren't always well behaved. So we pulled off.
Shepherd estimates she files 2 to 3 eviction notices against tenants each month. She says tenants fall behind in their rent payments because of what she views as the poor life choices they make.
A lack of work ethic. People don't feel like they have to work 40 hours a week. I usually work 90, and this was before I retired. But it seems like I still work 90 now. But I just think I put my work ethic first. I didn't have any children. And it seems like now people put children, have as many children as they possibly can, without being able to afford them. And I see that being a major problem, especially with single women.
But it's not that simple. For many people, like Moesha Tyner, survival is a daily struggle. When she lost her job at Burger King, she got another job as a cashier at Walmart. That job also paid $9 an hour with no benefits. She receives $800 a month in food stamps. Her estranged husband pays the gas and electric bill, but he too works a minimum wage job at a local bar restaurant. Tyner received an eviction notice from Shepherd after Tyner began withholding rent, hoping that it would force her landlord to make repairs and bring in professional fumigators.
All I can do if a tenant has stopped working with me, I have to proceed. If they work with me, you know, I think we can get through all of these things that need to be repaired.
Tyner's downstairs neighbor at the Center Street property has also begun withholding rent. Delilah Grant keeps a bucket in her living room to catch water leaking through her ceiling from Tyner's bathroom upstairs. Grant also complains about bugs.
We always pay rent on time, and then all of a sudden when we start seeing, you know, stuff that really need to be fixed or exterminated, you know, she would just push us to the side, but she would still call for her rent.
Grant saved some messages from Shepherd on her cell phone.
Delilah, this is Cindy Shepherd. I know you've been served with a 5-day notice. You haven't paid the amount that you owe. So I'm proceeding with the eviction. I thought you could be decent and give me a call or bring in some money to stop the eviction.
Grant has 3 children and works as a certified nursing assistant. She is now looking for someplace else to live.
I don't have $35 or $25 every time I go and try to put in an application for apartment, and then they want 2 or 3 months security and first months. How am I gonna come up with all that with on 3 kids? All you can do is just, yeah, pray and do day by day. I mean, I still have a roof, but I don't know how long I'm gonna have a roof.
Lawyers who represent tenants say withholding rent is one of the worst strategies tenants can use. Under the Illinois Landlord-Tenant Code, tenants have to pay rent on time unless they can prove their unit is uninhabitable. Emily Petrie is an attorney with Prairie Legal Services, which helps low-income clients.
Under Illinois law, having issues with your landlord not making repairs and not fixing problems is not a complete defense to an eviction case. There's probably an argument to be made, given all of the issues, and the judge would have to look at the specific issues, that rent should be a lot less. But it's really hard to argue that rent should be wiped out, that it should be $0, because the tenant was still staying there, was still able to have some use of their apartment.
Petrie says a better strategy is for the tenant to pay some rent or else place the whole month's rent in escrow with Prairie Legal Services or other legal counsel. That underscores another difficulty for low-income tenants. Most cannot afford representation. Prairie Legal Services says it doesn't have the funds or staff to take on landlord-tenant cases that don't have a strong legal defense.
When I went to court, it was a learning experience. I had to find a way to be my own advocate, but I knew that I had the heart to represent myself in a positive way.
One Bloomington tenant who went to court is Anthony Middleton, a part-time construction worker. He sued AB Rentals in Bloomington after a fire swept through its property at 812 West Washington Street last February. Middleton's unit, unlike the others, received only smoke damage. After the fire, AB changed the locks in all of the rental units. Middleton says he called the property manager a number of times seeking to get into his unit to collect his belongings. He was concerned about his computers and other electronic equipment. Before the landlord responded, his unit was burglarized.
The fire, it was heartbreaking. But the burglary after the fire, it took some time for me to function and get back to the normal things of life.
In court, AB Rentals was represented by counsel and also brought a witness to buttress its case. At times during the proceedings, Middleton appeared so frustrated he would place his head in his hands.
You know, I kind of like lost it a little bit, and I thought I was going to lose. But something in my heart kept saying, speak the truth, speak the truth. And everything to sort itself out. God was always with me.
Middleton sought $4,000 from AB as replacement value for the items that were stolen. In court, AB's representative, Lina Bunnell, maintained the company owed Middleton nothing and could not be held liable for the burglary. Judge David Butler ruled in Middleton's favor. He said AB was not responsible for replacement value of the stolen items, but still had to pay Middleton $1,700 to compensate for his loss.
I was telling the truth, so thank God that we have a justice system where the judge made the decision for me.
Lawyers who represent tenants say Middleton's success is an exception. Moesha Tyner, the resident at the Center Street apartment, represented herself in the eviction case brought by her landlord, Cynthia Shepherd. At a hearing in August, Tyner agreed to move out with her children within 30 days in exchange for not having to pay 3 months back rent and other expenses her landlord claimed she was owed. The judge never heard Tyner's complaints about her living conditions because Tyner agreed to settle before the case went to trial.
If it beats for me having to pay $3,000 and not having a eviction on my background, I will take that.
Tyner is now seeking a new place to live. She has contacted some of the local homeless shelters, but she says they are either full or can't accept her with her 6 children.
It's hard, but I've been looking, and it's like I don't want to get another landlord that's going to have to go through this.
A few weeks ago, Shepherd did send some workmen over to Tyner's unit to patch up some of the walls and ceiling and paint the outside of the house. Shepherd says she's getting Tyner's old unit ready for new renters. I'm Judy Valente.
Most landlord-tenant disputes in the county are settled out of court. Those that do come to court usually go before McLean County Associate Judge David Butler. Butler's the judge who signed the eviction order for Moesha Tyner to vacate her unit on Center Street after Tyner reached an agreement with her landlord to move out. Butler tells GLT's Judy Valente that in landlord-tenant cases, it's often difficult to balance human concerns with the mandate of the law.
The scenario you describe, where you put a single parent out who has one or six kids, is always hard. And I've had numerous cases like that where it's very hard to enter an order of possession that tells somebody, you got 7 days to move everything you own out of this apartment or this house and without knowing where to put it. One of the things that I try to do to lessen that is on the day we set the trial is typically several weeks after we set it, and I remind the tenant at that time that if the court finds that the landlord is entitled to have possession back, they won't have a month to move. It's typically 7 days. We try to be consistent so that they're not caught by surprise on the day of the trial when they're ordered to move out in 7 days. The judge can't show compassion to one party at the expense of someone else.
Judge Butler, I've sat in your courtroom a few times, and I've noticed that a number of the tenants can't afford to have attorneys if they're in a dispute with their landlord. They try to represent themselves. They have very little idea of what to do in a court setting. Does that not put the tenant at a distinct disadvantage in any type of dispute, even if the tenant has a good cause?
Certainly it does. And that's true. It's certainly true if the landlord has an attorney, but it's also true if the landlord is also representing themselves, because the landlords are experienced at this. They have probably gotten some training from a lawyer. They've paid a lawyer for advice on how to proceed with eviction cases, and they're more experienced at it because I see some of the same professional landlords in court every few weeks. So they've gone through this enough times that they know the law better and the system better. So, yeah, a tenant who does not have a lawyer is at a distinct disadvantage in these proceedings.
Is there something you do differently when people come in without attorneys, particularly the tenants who are often very ill-equipped in a court setting?
Well, under the Supreme Court rules, we can relax the rules of evidence a little bit, but both sides have to present evidence that is admissible, and you can't penalize the party who has a lawyer, you know, by not following the rules of evidence. And oftentimes it's a matter of not knowing what's admissible and what's not. But also, most tenants don't know the procedural requirements that the landlord must go through in order to be entitled to an eviction. And oftentimes the landlord will make mistakes in serving the 5-day notice, and the tenant doesn't recognize that. And the court is in a position where the judge really should not become an advocate for one side or the other, raise issues that one party has not raised. So it's difficult. Sometimes you're sitting here watching the evidence and you're thinking, if this party had a lawyer, they could resist this eviction proceeding, but it's not appropriate for the court then to put on an advocate's hat and start helping one side to prevail in the legal dispute over the other side.
In general, do you think tenants understand what their rights are? There is such a thing as an Illinois Tenant's Bill of Rights.
No, I don't think the majority of tenants know their rights. They can get some, you know, it varies from county to county, but they can get some legal advice or legal aid offices that sometimes will appear in court and give advice without entering their appearance as their legal counsel, and that helps.
There are some landlords who are in your court week after week. What does that say to you?
Well, and there are some landlords who are seldom in there, and there's a difference. Part of it has to do with the quality of the premises that the landlord is renting. If it's good quality premises, apartments or houses, and they're well kept, typically the rent is higher, and they're only going to accept tenants who have demonstrated the ability to pay the rent. If a landlord has property that's was not worth as much, it's low-income rental property, they're going to get low-income tenants applying for that. People will normally rent premises that are comparable to what they can afford. And so, or if you have landlords that rent the low-income apartments, oftentimes they're not in as good a repair, oftentimes they're smaller, they're going to get tenants that have lower income, and that's the kind of apartment they can afford or the house that they can afford. And it doesn't take much when you're on, if you're living from paycheck to paycheck and your income is marginal, it doesn't take much in terms of a financial emergency that comes up to make the tenant unable to pay the rent. There's an interesting dynamic here. People tend to, if they have car payments, if they have a cell phone, they will pay those things before they pay their rent because the consequences of not paying those debts are more immediate. They get their phone shut off, they get their car repossessed, but they know that when they don't pay the rent, the consequences won't be immediate. It takes a while for the landlord to be able to evict someone.
What are the types of cases that tenants bring before you? Landlords are mostly evictions, trying to get people out who haven't paid their rent, I would imagine.
Well, it's not real common for the tenant to actually initiate the lawsuit against the landlord. It does happen. The most typical scenario there is when the landlord doesn't return the security deposit. The tenant leaves, they don't owe the landlord any rent, but the landlord has a reason for not returning the deposit that the tenant does not agree with. And so the tenant files suit against the landlord to get their deposit back. That's the most common.
How frequent would you say that is? How common?
I personally see them, that type of suit, maybe two or three, four times a year.
The law as it's written, the Illinois Code regarding landlord-tenant relations, is it weighted heavily, in your opinion, toward the landlord, or does it strike a balance?
I think it is a balance. The parties start out with an agreement. It's called a lease. You can have an oral lease, but most leases are written. The lease certainly favors the landlord because the landlord is the party that drafts those. So typical provisions in a lease would be that if the tenant doesn't pay, of course, the landlord can terminate the lease, but also there's almost always an attorney's fees provision, which means if the landlord has to sue the tenant to gain possession or back rent, the tenant has to pay reasonable attorney's fees that the landlord incurs. So the leases certainly favor the landlord because they're drafting them for that purpose. The legal process is far more balanced. The problem is that tenants are often less able to represent themselves and present their case in court than either a landlord who has an attorney or a landlord who doesn't have an attorney but is experienced in going through the eviction process.
Is there a particular case or a couple of cases that come to mind that illustrate the difficulties that you sometimes face in having to make decisions with tenants who are struggling and landlords who have a legitimate claim?
Of course, the court's duty is to do what's right, to grant each side the rights that they're entitled to under the law. The hard part is when doing what is right creates a hardship for someone else, and that is usually the tenant. Now, sometimes it's not. Sometimes you'll have a landlord who depends on that rent to be able to pay for that property or even as their income, and when the tenants don't pay, it creates a serious financial hardship for them. Occasionally, the landlord makes a mistake in the process they have to go through in order to gain possession, and you have to deny possession to them, even though clearly the tenant is not paying the rent. For example, if the landlord doesn't follow the proper procedures for serving the tenant with the eviction notice, what we call the 5-day notice for failing to pay rent. And sometimes, you know, I feel bad for a landlord who's just trying to make a living and basically has to support somebody else because they made a mistake procedurally. You know, we think in terms of compassion for the tenants because they are usually the ones who are having financial hardships. But oftentimes, we think of landlords, maybe incorrectly, as being businesses that have lots of money and lots of units, and they won't miss one tenant's rent. But that isn't always the case. Many of the landlords only own a few rental properties, and they depend on that money to pay the taxes and then the insurance on that property. They may have a mortgage on that property to pay for the repairs, inspection fees, things like that, before they ever make any income off the property. And so if you have a tenant that won't pay and won't leave, if that goes on 4, 5, 6, 7 months, the landlord is now has a financial hardship.
From your perspective in court, and you see a lot of cases, is there some aspect of the law that you feel could be changed, should be changed?
You know, this statute has been in existence for a long time, and I understand the statute well and the notice requirements, and I think every aspect of that statute is for a reason. I don't know that I would have any sweeping changes that I would offer to that statute. It's product of many, you know, years of legislature trying to reach a statute that is fair to both sides. Now, we're acting under the assumption that it's always the tenant who doesn't abide by the contract. But the truth is landlords sometimes don't either. They don't keep the premises in a habitable condition. Sometimes mold develops or there are leaks that they don't fix and things like that. You'll find abuses on both sides. Tenants sometimes damage the property or they'll leave it in a filthy condition, which costs money for the landlord to clean up. But you also have some landlords who their property is not very suitable for human habitation, you know. So you can see sometimes you go into an apartment and you can't tell whether this is a tenant that is not very cleanly or is it a landlord that's not maintained a property very well. And sometimes it's both, especially with low-income housing.
David Butler is an associate judge of the McLean County Circuit Court. He oversees many of the landlord-tenant cases. Thank you so much for talking about this.
You're welcome, Judy.
I'm Judy Valente.
Representatives of Prairie State Legal Services are available on Thursday mornings on the third floor of the McLean County Courthouse to offer advice to tenants who can't afford lawyers. On certain Friday mornings, tenants and landlords who are representing themselves in disputes can also seek free mediation from trained volunteers at the courthouse. Anyone interested in mediation can find out more at the Self-Help Legal Center in the Law Library of the McLean County Law and Justice Center.
Support for GLT comes from the Economic Development Council, presenting BN by the Numbers Thursday, September 28th at ISU's Bone Student Center. It's an update on local economic progress, plus a look at STEM with Muddy Boots. Tickets available by emailing Becky at bnbiz.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos plans to end the Obama administration's rules for investigating allegations of sexual violence on campus. She announced that Thursday on a college campus in Virginia. So how will changes to Title IX enforcement affect campuses like Illinois State University and Illinois Wesleyan University? GLT's Ryan Denham asked ISU's Title IX coordinator Tony Walesby for his reaction. They started by talking about the federal law's full scope, which is much broader than the gender equity in college sports that many people associate with Title IX.
Prior to 2011, when the government issued its first Dear Colleague letter, or the most recent Dear Colleague letter, and a series of Dear Colleague letters about sexual misconduct, you likely would have heard about Title IX in the athletics context. So Title IX is a federal law. It's Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972. It prohibits discrimination in K-12 higher education institutions as well, discrimination based on sex or gender. And basically, it covers, again, athletics, but also sex discrimination, sexual harassment, sexual misconduct, students who are pregnant. It covers all forms of gender or sex-based discrimination.
How big a deal is Title IX here at ISU?
Sure. Very significant. You know, the university has historically put a lot of effort towards supporting our students relative to Title IX issues, both students who are accused and students who are coming forward. If a student comes forward today, they're given a packet of resources. They're given information, a Title IX handbook that relates to student and employees. It outlines various resources that the campus has. In terms of investigations, if it's a matter involving a faculty, staff, or student, then typically the Office of Equal Opportunity and Access would handle that matter or investigate that matter. If it's an issue involving student-to-student sexual misconduct, currently, those are being handled by the Dean of Students Title IX office.
Can you kind of give a general example of a Title IX case that you've dealt with here at ISU? Just to kind of put this in context for people who may still be maybe not understanding what Title IX actually means in practice when a case actually surfaces.
Sure, and I can give you a couple examples. So we might have examples for with respect to, let's say, a student comes forward. In my example, it will be a female student, but doesn't have to be. a female student comes forward and says that she was interacting with a male student. Again, doesn't have to be a male student, it can be a female student. But they're interacting, two students are interacting, and there's an allegation of a sexual assault. Touching could be a variety of forms of sexual assault. Could also be sexual harassment, but in my example, sexual assault, student comes forward, then we'll launch an investigation into the matter. A student could also come forward and say, you know, I'm trying to get an accommodation because I'm a student who is pregnant, and I'm having some difficulties in my pregnancy, and I need to skip some exams, and so I need an accommodation to help me facilitate that. That could also happen. A male student may come forward and say that he's being subjected to sexual harassment, unwanted jokes of a sexual nature, unwanted comments, gender stereotyping, those types of things.
What have some of these Obama administration guidance letters meant for ISU? I think these my understanding is that these Dear Colleague letters kind of spell out very specific expectations for universities?
That's right. So the first Dear Colleague letter that came out really under the Obama administration that started more of an emphasis on this. So, of course, schools like Illinois State University, since 1972, have been obligated to make sure that all of our faculty, staff, and students are free from discrimination and harassment, that if a person feels they've been subjected to discrimination, we have a very fair, thorough process that investigates those matters, and if there's an issue, that we take care of those matters. So that's been longstanding. In April 2011, the Dear Colleague letter came out from the U.S. Department of Education Office for Civil Rights that reminded universities that if you have a Title IX complaint, if a student comes forward and alleges, for example, sexual assault, then the university should take a look at it, not just the police. What the Department of Education was telling us is that they noticed that some schools were saying, a student's come forward, they've alleged sexual assault, the police are handling it, therefore we don't have a role. And the government put forth the Dear Colleague letter in part to remind schools that you still have a Title IX obligation to review those matters, to investigate those matters. And then from that Dear Colleague letter and the subsequent ones, they outlined more, you know, an expectation of 60 days to do the investigation, what the investigations might look like, a series of guidance that have been coming from the Department of Education.
So what can happen if we don't adhere to these Dear Colleague letters and what it spells out? What could ISU potentially lose if we just kind of blow that off?
So with respect to the federal government's enforcement, what the U.S. Department of Education can do is withhold all federal funding for Illinois State. Say that the university didn't do something right, the government comes in, takes a look, and says, hey, you've got something wrong, we want you to fix it. And if Illinois State refused to do that, which, again, I can't imagine would be the case, then that's one of the options. They can refer to the Department of Justice for litigation. They can also suspend or stop federal funding coming to the university.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm speaking with Tony Walesby, the Title IX coordinator at Illinois State University. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos made a major policy speech on Thursday that will impact Title IX at college campuses across the country. She says any new policy on investigating sexual assault on college campuses must balance the rights of victims and the accused. She announced plans to replace Obama administration guidance that spells out schools' responsibilities. She calls that a failed system and says the rights of all parties must be taken into account. What are your initial impressions on Education Secretary Betsy DeVos's remarks today on Title IX?
I'm interested to see ultimately what the government puts forth. You know, I think that Illinois State University, as well as other universities across the country, we've taken these matters seriously for many, many decades. And so I also think, again, I'm newer to campus, but I also think that we've balanced the rights of all parties in these matters. And so when I watched the secretary's presentation today, I thought, you know, some of the things that she was emphasizing in terms of rights of the accused and a fair approach, all those things are currently what Illinois State is doing. And so we're always interested, of course, in what the government guidance is. We always want to learn and make sure that we're complying with the law. I would say at this point right now, you know, we're always interested to hear feedback from our students, from our faculty, from our staff regarding how things are going. But I think our process right now is a very fair one, a very thorough one, and gives all parties the opportunity to present their side and then we reach a decision based on the evidence that's presented.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, Betsy DeVos, she appeared most interested in trying to balance those rights of the accused versus the victim. She said that a system biased toward finding a student responsible for sexual misconduct, that system is also committing discrimination. So can you talk a little bit about that balance and specifically that burden of proof question that is sort of at the center of all this and how burden of proof kind of differs in Title IX cases versus what someone might see in like a criminal court case?
So if we think of a criminal court case, so we've seen TV shows, right? We may know personal experience that a criminal court is beyond a reasonable doubt, right? So a jury of your peers or a judge, by a reasonable doubt, either you've done it or not based on the evidence that's presented. For civil rights cases, and this is true of Title IX, but also the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Civil Rights Act, for all civil rights enforcement, the preponderance of the evidence standard is used. And basically that means if you think of the scales of justice equally weighted 50%, 51% or 50.1% on either side wins the day in a civil rights matter. This is also comparable. We may be aware of celebrities, for example, who have gone through a criminal court and they've been found not guilty, you know, by that higher standard, the beyond reasonable doubt standard. And then you have that same celebrity who's sued in civil court and they're found responsible and they have to pay money or monetary damages. That's because of the evidentiary standard difference. That's that preponderance of the evidence standard that's used in the civil court.
So you're kind of referring to the O.J. Simpson type of situation, the criminal versus the civil.
That's an example as well. That's right. So a person may find themselves not guilty in that court of law, the criminal court of law, but then find themselves guilty in the civil court, and that's where the monetary fines come in. And so for civil rights laws, the government has always put forth that the preponderance of the evidence standard is the one that's appropriate to use for those types of cases. And so that's what we use at Illinois State as well.
So something else that Betsy DeVos said Thursday in her remarks is that it's her belief that the Obama administration, quote, weaponized the Office for Civil Rights as it relates to Title IX. I know you're relatively new to campus, but is that how it felt here at ISU, that the Obama administration guidance had weaponized that Office of Civil Rights?
It's an interesting question. And I guess I would say that I used to work at the Office for Civil Rights as a federal investigator. So before coming to ISU, I was at the University of Michigan and then University of Illinois. But before that, I was an OCR investigator for about 10 years. And so I guess I haven't viewed it that way per se. But I understand that folks have felt that the government, through its guidance, have been trying to hold schools to a higher standard or to a different standard. And so I would say that certainly starting in 2011, the government's Dear Colleague letters have really highlighted the importance of sexual misconduct on campus, preventative measures, how to properly address these matters through investigations. And so in that respect, I think OCR has done a very good job of getting the word out about this is an important topic, these are things that we need to focus on, and so that's been very helpful. I know that schools have sometimes felt that the government has put a lot of emphasis on it and has been less willing to help out. And I know that that's what the secretary said on Thursday. But my experience, and again, I used to work for that agency, so it may be a bit different, but my experience is that the government has been helpful in these areas.
Ultimately, what would be your top priorities as policymakers make revisions to how Title IX is approached at college campuses? What would you rank number one, number two, number three?
So I guess I would say that ultimately, and this is before Thursday's speech, we've always focused in on the rights of all the students involved. And so I would say that those are the top priorities that we have in any process. You know, faculty, staff, or student, if you feel that you've been discriminated against, we want you to have confidence in the process, that you are heard, that we gather all the information that you provide, that we speak to witnesses that you identify, that we fairly evaluate all the evidence that we've gathered. And on the other hand, if you've been accused of something serious, I also want the student, faculty, or staff to feel like this process was fair and open. I was able to tell my side of the situation. I was able to provide all the evidence that I wanted. I identified witnesses. Those witnesses were contacted. And in the end, there was a very fair and thorough review of all the evidence. And then here's the determination that was reached by the university. And so I want folks to feel a sense of confidence in the process itself. That's always been my top priority.
That's Tony Walesby, the Title IX coordinator at Illinois State University. I'm Ryan Denham.
Illinois Wesleyan University sent GLT a statement with its reaction to the Title IX announcement. Vice President for Student Affairs and Dean of Students Carla Carney Hall says Wesleyan remains committed to creating and sustaining a campus free of sexual violence. She says Wesleyan will always provide support for victims of sexual assault, harassment, and domestic violence. And she says staff remain deeply committed to fair campus judicial processes for all students involved. Education Secretary DeVos says public input will be sought in developing a new policy for investigating Title IX complaints.
You know that little sticker on fruit, how when you pick it off, it like damages the fruit?
And then trying to flick it off your fingers, right? And you're like, why does it have to be so hard?
That is design. And design affects everything around us.
And if done right, everything around us could be transformed to bring a better experience.
Ideas about the power of design, that's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
The TED Radio Hour, Sundays at 10 a.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, reminding families that September is Life Insurance Awareness Month. You can take simple steps today to protect what matters most, from your family to your business. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. 2 years of effort, fundraising, and volunteer coordination are culminating tomorrow in a household hazardous waste collection in Bloomington Normal. That's tomorrow from 8 to 2 at the Rivian Auto Plant on Bloomington's west side. GLT's Mike McCurdy talked with Ecology Action Center Director Michael Brown last month about the event. The last hazardous waste collection event registered a 22% increase in the number of motor vehicles dropping off stuff for disposal. That was down from the inaugural event 4 years ago. But Brown says the amount of waste collected has increased.
So we continue to see our volumes of waste increases. Awareness grows. Essentially, this unique private-public partnership, how we're now funding these events, actually the entire campaign to raise money also acts as an awareness campaign. So awareness of the need to properly dispose of hazardous waste is at an all-time high for our community.
So is there a point where these kinds of events might be even less frequent than every 2 years? Do you think education about purchasing such items or the fact that you're collecting it regularly will lead to a decrease in the need to collect such items?
Yes and no. So big picture, you know, while awareness is at an all-time high and participation continues to increase in many ways, we're still fighting this massive machine of consumerism where so many goods are being created that contain hazardous materials. And so we're fighting some pretty significant forces there in trying to change behaviors here on our local level.
But every person that drops something off gets a touch. They get educated little bit about this. I mean, they're spending some time in the car, I assume. You have an opportunity. I mean, they're captive, right?
Absolutely.
So you have an opportunity to say, hey, maybe next time you should buy this, you know, the 30-gallon jug of Absolutely. Roundup instead of the 50.
Right. So every car does receive information about some local programs to dispose of some things that can be locally any time of year. But as well, yes, we are trying to educate about alternatives, safer alternatives, programs like our Yard Smart program, which promotes less hazardous yard care solutions for a healthy but beautiful yard.
So I've used words like items. You've said the word waste. We're talking about anything that's toxic, corrosive, explosive or reactive. What are some common examples in these categories?
So we're looking at things like oil-based paint. We're looking at things like fuel, like gas, oil, waste motor oil, cleaning oil, all those kind of things. We're looking at highly corrosive cleaners, drain cleaner, things like that, pool chemicals. Mm-hmm. Just the list goes on and on. We're literally talking about thousands and thousands of different consumer goods. And so it's really even hard for us to put out a definitive list of what we can accept so much as we put out, you know, some guidelines and then information on what we can't accept.
Is there enough consumer common sense here to know what the HHW will accept and what you won't?
There is. I think most people know what we're talking about. I think the biggest frustration comes when people do want to dispose of things like latex paint at these events. Latex paint is not easy to dispose of outside of a disposal option, but yet it is not hazardous. And so we don't take it at these events. events because it costs us about the same as it does for the hazardous oil-based paint.
And latex is pretty easy. You can just pour it out on a bunch of newspapers, let it dry, exactly. And wad it up and throw it away.
Exactly. It's safe and legal to put in the trash once it's dried out.
Electronics? TVs? Old stereos? Calculators?
Absolutely. Yeah. Home Sweet Home Ministries is our e-waste partner for this event, and so they will be there on-site taking these items. E-waste does contain some hazardous materials, and so yes, we are happy to take that and usually take large volumes of those materials at this event.
Every time I see a TV at the side of the road, I just roll my eyes. It's like, come on. Yep. And I see a lot of TVs. I mean, all those big tube TVs are sort of aging out right now, so I'm seeing a lot of those on the side of the road.
Exactly, but from our estimates from the waste industry, there's possibly as much as 10 years more of those still out there that we'll be dealing with this.
Another decade.
Yes.
Wow. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy in the studio with Michael Brown. He's the executive director of the Ecology Action Center with some news about the next household hazardous waste collection in McLean County. So you still have some fundraising to go. Most of those will be at this point, the other 45% you need to raise will be individual contributions?
Yes. We've got, I think, all the big sponsors on board that we're probably getting for this time around. But yes, individual contributions in the past have, even day of the event, we pull in thousands of dollars of contributions right there on site. And so yes, we encourage people to continue to contribute to make this possible, because it really only is possible through this unique private public partnership. We're one of the very few communities in the entire state of Illinois that is actually properly still handling this issue in the absence of regular state collection events.
So where is the state? Where is the federal government in protecting the environment? Why is it up to the Ecology Action Center and local governments to foot the bill and stage these kinds of events?
Well, we all know there's some issues at the state level in the state of Illinois right now. And it's not just environmental. It's not just Illinois EPA. It is across the board. And so the state needs to really get its house in order and take care of things. And so we know right now in the interim that we cannot depend on the state. And so we are stepping up. However, we and others across the state and the nation are also looking at the bigger picture solutions. And so we know that while this is highly successful here in our community, where we're meeting the need better than most communities in Illinois, the bigger picture solution is really full life cycle solutions to these products. And so Ecology Action Center and many other organizations are part of the Illinois Product Stewardship Council, and also there's the National Product Stewardship Council. These are coalitions of manufacturers, retailers, waste industry professionals that were working together to look at these needs. And so, for example, looking at oil-based paint, if we all up front understand that it has a bigger life cycle need than just us buying it, us using it, if we upfront are all willing to pay a little bit more in that purchase price as consumers, because this is the realistic, real cost of the product, then in the end of the system, ideally we could have an easy, convenient disposal option, maybe right there back at the retailer.
Is oil-based paint even being manufactured anymore? I thought they were phasing it out.
It's being phased out. It's still available for some specific applications. And so that's maybe a poor example in that context, but people still have it. Mm. And so, but the point being, it's an obvious product that everyone's familiar with that is hazardous. But there's other examples. E-waste, which actually is a poor example right now in the state of Illinois. We've been trying to deal with this e-waste problem for several years. There's actually been multiple different variations on an e-waste law. There's actually a new one that's going into effect here in 2018 that hopefully will finally address the issue properly. I mean, we have in McLean County been lucky to have good e-waste collection points that take most e-waste materials from residents, but yet most communities in Illinois are not so lucky. So there's a lot of smaller communities, smaller counties that don't have anything at all, or they may take some basic things but not take expensive things like CRT, tube-style televisions. So we need a better comprehensive solution. This has been an ongoing process. Waste professionals, municipalities, counties, retailers, manufacturers working together for years, and I think we are finally getting close to the real solution.
Who's the contractor? Who's taking this stuff?
So we've hired Tredebi, which is a hazardous waste company that are actually international. They actually have done our past two locally funded events as well. Very good company to work with.
And what do they actually do? On site and then later?
Sure. And so on site, they're the ones that are taking the material out of people's cars. They're first identifying material. Some things come unlabeled or unidentified. And so some things they have to use an on site lab to actually determine what the heck this is so that they know how to handle it safely, because that right there could create a crisis very quickly if something's handled
right. You don't want to mix. I mean, you don't want to start your own chemical chain reaction.
Exactly.
At the parking lot there where you're collecting it.
So identifying, bulking things up. And so they bring a whole, I don't know, how many hundreds of 55-gallon drums, things that can be bulked up, whether it's, you know, all the oil-based paint or all the used motor oil, or those things are bulked up. The containers are actually thrown out. Those are harmless. And then, yeah, everything's transported to appropriate facilities. Some things can be recycled. Some things can be made into energy, like that waste fuel oil is used as an energy source, and other oil-based things sometimes can as well. Some things can be recycled, talking about like the mercury that we find in CFL lamps, fluorescent tubes, lead that is found in electronics, and so on and so forth. So some things can be recycled, but that is kind of a minority amongst these things. Some things need to be stabilized and then are put into a hazardous waste landfill essentially for perpetuity, which needs to be very closely monitored, has extra systems for that monitoring in contrast to a regular solid waste landfill. Some things are so unstable that actually they are incinerated is deemed the safest way to dispose of them because they're not even safe in that hazardous waste landfill.
Michael Brown of the Ecology Action Center spoke with GLT's Michael McCurdy. The McLean County Household Hazardous Waste Collection event is tomorrow, Saturday, from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Rivian Automotive, located at 100 North Mitsubishi Motorway in Normal. Residents must enter the facility using the south gate from the West College Avenue instead of the west side entrance used in the past. For the fastest entry into the event, the Ecology Action Center is asking all residents to arrive at Rivian from the east on West College Avenue. This is WGLT Normal. I'm Charlie Schlenker.